Well, let me say a couple things by way of introduction. While I entitled these Kierkegaards The Way of Life, he has a book entitled The Way of Life, or The Stages on the Way of Life, Stadia på livets väg. I don't want to have Kierkegaard, wherever he is in his celestial sphere now, angered over my presuming to represent him. So let me say that I borrow from Kierkegaard and do not ascribe everything I say to him. He'd probably correct me at points anyway. But I'll try the best I can to represent him. I became acquainted with Kierkegaard somewhat by chance back in the early 30s, late 20s, at the University of Minnesota. There was a professor, Dr. David Swenson. Well, he wasn't a doctor, really. I guess somebody had given him a doctor's degree, but he was head of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Minnesota. He had only a Bachelor of Arts degree, I was told. He disdained degrees. Started out as a teacher in mathematics and then went from there to logic and from logic to his interest in religion. And he told how he had chanced to run on to a book by Kierkegaard. I think it was probably the fragments or the postscript to the fragments. Anyway, he had chanced to run into that book. It was in Danish, of course. It hadn't been translated into English. Hardly anything at that time of Kierkegaard's had been translated into English, and probably very few people knew about this remote Dane who lived 100 years earlier. But David Swenson, who could read, he was Swedish, he could read Scandinavian, whether Swedish or Danish or Norwegian, and he said that he couldn't drop the book. He read all night, and it was a turning point in his life, much like C.S. Lewis says of George MacDonald, that getting a hold of George MacDonald's writings and sermons caught him. Well, for Swenson, Kierkegaard was a tremendous excitement. And he was the only American, really, at the time, who ever taught anything about Kierkegaard, who ever talked much about him. And that was understandable, because he had lived 100 years earlier. He was from a small country. The Danish language, or the Scandinavian language, isn't known very well. And he was just kind of marooned up there in Copenhagen by language. A little of his stuff had been translated into German back there, but not a great deal. Some of his more lurid titles, like The Diary of a Seducer, that's one title of Kierkegaard's. He'd probably, that I think was translated, and a few others. But I remember Swenson saying that in time, the world will discover Kierkegaard, and they will recognize that he and Plato of Athens are the two great thinkers of the world. That those two, above all others, combine a rare gift of dialectic reasoning, the powers of reasoning, plus the gift of a poet, putting these profound concepts into concrete forms. It's almost, I wouldn't have believed it, really, that this could have happened so soon. But not long after, say 10 years after, Kierkegaard became the rage in almost every field: philosophy, theology, the arts. He was culted everywhere. Of course, he was classified, and rightly so, with the existentialists, and they were having their day. And But in consequence, Kierkegaard got to be translated into every language of the world, really. And he's one of the dominant figures. You'd have to come to terms with him if you're going to do anything in theology or anything, I would think, in philosophy, too. He was a strange guy. Somebody has said, can you really take him seriously? Because wasn't he kind of nuts? And, he was erratic. There was no question about that. If you have read anything of his biography, he was the youngest child of a wool merchant, and the wool merchant was quite old when Kierkegaard was born. This wool merchant was a melancholy person who, it was said, carried a kind of unforgiven sin with him most of his life. But he was highly intellectual and had the power of description. Said when Søren, the boy, wanted to go out on the streets of Copenhagen and see things at night, his father would say, "Well, let's take a walk." And so they would walk around the room, around inside of the house, from one room to another, and the father would describe imaginary scenes, and the boy found this more intriguing than going out. I don't know if they had Tivoli at the time, but going out into the streets of Denmark. So he had this gift of description, of portrayal, from his father. He died at the age of 42 from a stroke, from apoplexy. It was said that when he collapsed on the floor and somebody came to pick him up or to help him up, he said, just leave it lie. The maid will sweep it up in the morning. He was a person of irony and humor. He fought tooth and nail with the church. He said at one time, if you want one sin less to be confessed on the day of judgment, stop going to church, because that's a sin. To give support to this institution that falls so far short of the Lord it represents. Well, he never married, though he was engaged, and broke the engagement. Nobody quite knew why, and this caused quite a stir, because a betrothal, an engagement, in that society at that time was tantamount to marriage. And to break a marriage, to break an engagement or a marriage was a very serious thing. While coming to his works, he wrote sometimes in pseudonym. He'd ascribe a piece of writing to another author, and use another name. There's a book, Anton Eller, Either Or, and the first part of the book is The Diary of the Seducer, and the second part of the book are letters from a friend of the seducer to persuade the friend to stop this this aesthetic or this non-ethical life that he's living, and become ethical in his living. And so he's got, he says he was up in an attic and found these two documents. The first, The Diary of a Seducer, and the second, letters to the diary, or to the seducer. And they're highly, highly intellectual and psychological and philosophical documents. I remember Jerry Pelican one time saying, wouldn't it be fine to publish this Diary of a Seducer with a lurid cover and put it on the bookshelves and have people buy it and discover after 10 pages that they were in some profound philosophical stuff, and discover that the seduction is only dismissed with a sentence, when they were already waiting for some kind of graphic description of how you do this. And But it, whole treatment is how a person who has no principles really plays with people, uses them. And this is called for by Kierkegaard the aesthetic stage. We'll go to the stages. There are three stages: the aesthetic stage, the ethical stage, and the religious stage. If we had a blackboard, I'd just put those three words on the board: aesthetic, ethical, and religious. Now, he uses the word aesthetic in his own way. This is not a discussion of what's beautiful and what's ugly. He says the aesthetic stage is that state in which a person does things by taste alone. He does not decide to do anything. He just drifts with his tastes to do it. The ethical stage, just to summarize, is the stage where a person decides that he will do things because they are right, and he'll not do things because they are wrong. Now he's in a stage of decision. He chooses between right and wrong. The religious stage is the overcoming of the impasse that a person encounters in the ethical stage. We'll come to all that. The aesthetic stage. There's another term he uses. The talent is the call. What you want to do and what you do well, that's your calling. Now, I suppose most of the vocational guidance stuff that we have follows that route. You take a test and you discover you're a good mathematician. And you like mathematics. And therefore the counselor says you ought to major in mathematics and probably go into engineering. Okay, another person doesn't like mathematics, but he likes to talk. He's a good communicator. And so he says, you like to do that. And you do it well. Therefore, you ought to be either an auctioneer or a pastor. Something that you like. Now, offhand, that sounds fairly good. I think most of us do a lot of things that way. But it isn't the whole show. Supposing a person likes to rob banks, and he's awfully good at it. This doesn't give him a calling to rob banks. Or if a person likes to seduce his friend's wives, and he's good at it, this doesn't give him a calling to do it. The talent is not the call. There's an ought here somewhere, O-U-G-H-T. But that's in the ethical stage. That's not in the aesthetic stage. The aesthetic stage is really the animal stage. A dog goes for a bone, and on the way, he sees another dog, a bigger one, coming toward the same bone, and so he stops and slinks away and doesn't take the bone. In describing that, you might say, well, dog number A decided to take the bone. On the way, he reconsidered and decided not to take the bone. The fact of the matter is, he made no decision at all. In the first instance, he was driven toward the bone by the tyrant called hunger, the appetite. On the way, he encountered another tyrant with a longer whip, fear, arising out of the environment. But he made no choice at all. He was just the pawn between these two tyrants, these two strong motivations. Now, a man walks down the street, and he sees the person ahead of him drop his billfold, and he says to himself, "This is my lucky day." He knows the fellow who dropped the billfold. He's rich. He doesn't need the money. And so he's on the way to picking up the billfold. Just as he's about to pick it up, out of the periphery of his eye, he notices a cop standing there. So he picks up the billfold all right, but then he quickly overtakes the man who dropped it and gives it to him. And the cop says to himself, "I'm glad there are still homeless people in the world." All he's done is behave just exactly like the dog. No difference at all. You're either driven by your appetites, and they're chaotic, the appetites, desires, dispositions on the one hand, and the forces of environment on the other hand. You yield to them, and you actually never defy them. You never say no to your appetite and no to the pressures on the outside, and in defiance of both of them, decide to do something that's right. That's the ethical stage. Now, the aesthetic stage means that you never do that. So, in fact, you never make a decision. Oh, yes, you might make a decision about neckties. They're not ethical decisions unless your wife happens not to like that color and you choose the color in defiance of her. You know, just to be mean, an ethical decision has been made, a wrong one, but an ethical one has been made. You've made a choice of ethical consequence. Well, I'm ahead of my game a little. A person can drift his whole life through, Kierkegaard would say, drift very discreetly. You know, you're a wise drifter. You never drift to a cross. You never drift into jail. You're just a good one. But it's always drifting, never defying anything and making a decision. You can, you're born, you don't decide to be born. You eat, you don't decide to eat. In your early stages, you cry and somebody puts food in your mouth. When you get of school age, you don't decide to go to school. Everybody goes to school. You just drift to school. A little push by your mother. You discover at school that everybody's most happy when you study. The teachers are nicer and your folks at home are nicer, so you yield to the pressure and study. And this gets to be a habit with you, so that at the end of your college or university career, you end up summa cum laude. You just were not strong enough to resist the pressures and fail. And then after a while, you fall in love, and you marry. And as you stand before the altar, you ought to shake yourself and ask how you got there. Did you ever decide to go there? You probably never did. And then after a while, you succeed in business, of course. And after a while, you're everybody's friend. And somebody says you ought to run for the Senate. So you run for the Senate. And you're elected. You really never decided to run for the Senate. Your friends kind of push you into that. And while you have a career in the Senate, you do very well because you listen well. And you're very clever in maneuvering where the pressure is. Kind of a nice balance between what you want and what they want. And then one day you die. You hadn't planned to die. And suddenly you are in hell. You never planned to go to hell either. There you are. And Kierkegaard says, that's the way it goes. And you see, So much of what we do actually is on that level. You have to admit that. But if it's all there, if everything is there, then you are completely in the aesthetic stage. Now, there's some quarrel about who stole from whom, but there's a lot of similarity between Henry Gibson and Kierkegaard. And on this level, on this stage, the aesthetic, Peer Gynt is probably the best example of all. Peer, as a young man in Norway, in the opening part of the play, I'm going to do some editing probably, this. In the opening part of the play, he's at a wedding. It's not his own wedding. And they celebrate weddings several days in Norway at that time. And in the course of the celebration, he becomes enamored of the bride, and she becomes enamored of him. And so, when nobody notices, they run away with each other. He abducts her, if you will. Nasty trick on his friend, the bridegroom. And then after a while, he tires of her. She's not as interesting as he thought. Besides, the police are after him. The dogs are. There's a bigger dog out there. And so he drops her. And he takes passage for America. Now, he, as a boy, lying looking at the clouds, he'd always hoped, dreamed, that he could be two things. That he could be rich, and that he could be an emperor. Well, Ibsen has him get rich in the United States by the slave trade, by getting money in this nefarious slave trade. And he gives some money, though, to the church to buy New Testaments for the Africans. He does that. And then he drifts around. He gets to Cairo, Egypt. And on the streets of Cairo one day, he's mistaken for an escaped lunatic. And he's brought into the lunatic asylum. And there he lives for a while. And while he's there, the lunatics one day elect him their emperor. Wasn't quite the kind of empire he planned. Then Ibsen brings him back to Norway. And the first person he meets in Norway is the button maker. Button maker has a pot and out of raw materials shapes buttons. This is a philosophical button maker. And the button maker says to Peer, you never turned out right. You were always a defective button. I think what we have to do is to put you in the pot and boil you over again and see if we can't produce a good button. And Peer, understanding his point, says, I know I haven't done what I should have done, and I've done a lot of stuff I ought not to have done, and I deserve to be punished. But I will not consent to be put in the pot and boiled over again, because the button that comes out will not be Peer Gynt, it'll be another button. And I won't consent to lose my selfhood. And the button maker said, don't get so excited, Peer. You've never been a self. You have nothing to lose. You've never been a self. You've always been, at any given point, the accidental result or combination of the chaotic appetites, inclinations, and tastes that you have, on the one hand, and the caprice or the whims of environment on the other hand. You've never from day to day been the same. You've always been just an accidental coming together of these anarchical, these chaotic, these disordered forces. You've never defied your appetites and your what you want to do on the one hand, and you've never defied the pressures from environment, and independent of both, decided to do that which was right. You've always just yielded. So you've never made a decision. Well, Peter goes in search of his friends or people who know him to see if they won't testify that at some time or another he has defied his desires, what he wants to do. He has defied what the world wants him to do, or lets him do. And independent of both, made a decision to do what's right. None of his friends will testify. They've never known him to do it, and they're honest. And Ibsen has him finally go to the devil, to ask the devil to testify, that at some time or another, he, Peer Gynt, decided to do the wrong. And made a decision anyway. And the devil, waxing honest, refuses to testify. He says, in effect, you've always done the wrong, and I appreciate that, but you've never been man enough to decide to do the wrong. And so there was an implication that there was no place in him, either in heaven or in hell, because he wasn't anything. He just wasn't a person. And that's what Kierkegaard, that's the stage that Kierkegaard describes. Now, let's see. Now, coming to the ethical stage, and I think let me say this, that if 99% of what I do because I drift between my anarchical desires and the capricious world, I still have 1% left where I happen to be a human being and not just nothing. But you surrender the whole bit, as we've been inclined to do, and inclined to say, well, everything you do is conditioned. You do it because of heredity, you do it because of environmental forces, or you do it because of biochemical constitution that you have, you do it, and there's no way for you to be free to choose. And we cop out into the aesthetic stage in very sophisticated ways in our society, and we need to be on the alert, because if that's all we are, then we are nothing. That is, we are animals. We do behave like the dog, but we are not human if we're only in the aesthetic stage. Now, the ethical stage. This is where a person decides, like Joshua, probably, in the Old Testament, choose ye this day whom ye will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That is, in a purely ethical way, you don't use the religious terms. You say that in every concrete situation, the issue of right and wrong will surface, and I will make a decision for the right to the full extent of my ability. I am committed to an ethical way of life. What happens then? Kierkegaard says that You start out in high expectation, make a great resolve. You've got your plan of operation, your resolutions. So like a knight on a white horse, you sally forth in the morning with all these resolutions. And then you come to the end of the day, and it's a pretty bad inventory. These resolutions are in tatters. And he says, day after day, this is what happens. Until the lack of ethical, the lack of ethical achievement, the more intense you are with it, the greater the gap between what you ought to have done and what you did do. Or the gap between what you pretend to be and what you are. And he has this gap. And he has this gap. And finally, the gap gets so bad that you, like Paul, will say, the good I would, I do not. The evil I would not, that I do. O wretched man, who will deliver me from this body, this death? I'm just not, an inventory of defections. I am one big defection. The gap gets to be under the tutelage, let's say, of the Holy Spirit, because after all, Kierkegaard rarely maroons the ethical stage from its religious overtones. God is in the picture. But, and this gap between what a person is and does, and what he ought to be, and what he ought to do, no matter how hard he tries, it's simply going to widen. The more sensitive he becomes, the wider the gap. So that he's totally frustrated if he's really sensitive. Now this doesn't mean that his efforts are of no consequence. This doesn't mean that he's a person who doesn't exercise their will, and for whom a will is just an illusion, so he might as well go back to the aesthetic stage and enjoy it. But the gap is a real one. And what's he going to do with the gap? Well, I think, again, it occurs to me that Ibsen, again, with Brandt, has a wonderful example of the ethical man who stubbornly pursues the ethical in every choice he makes, and is trying by narrowing the gap, or by not having a gap, trying to justify himself before God, trying to get God's approval. And that dramatic picture at the end, when he hears the avalanche coming, his whole family is falling apart because of this cruel ethical pursuit, in a sense, misdirected, but where the avalanche comes, and just before it hits him, he hears the voice out of the avalanche: God is grace. Deus caritas. It isn't, you don't win God. When you think of the ethical and the aesthetic over against each other, to have Peer Gynt on the one hand and Brandt on the other hand, I think makes some sense. And of course, this book of Kierkegaard's, either or, Enten Eller, where he's got this diary of a seducer and then the letters of this rather prosaic friend, sort of county judge, I guess, to this brilliant, reflective, let's say unscrupulous, aesthete or aesthetic person. And that's interesting too, that Kierkegaard has the sinner be the attractive one, the scintillating one, and has the ethical person, the good man, be rather dull. But it's one of Kierkegaard's ways of saying that goodness does not necessarily adhere to the scintillating ones, or at least goodness is not relevant to one or the other. But the aesthetic, the ethical stage leaves you with a gap. And in the gap, Kierkegaard says, all sorts of things, guilt, fears, nameless fears. It's the this dreadful thing of being what you were not supposed to be, and insensitive to it. Now, how do you get out of this gap? There's one little detour. It isn't exactly a detour, but he slips it in here. One way is of course, to go back, just give it up. and say, no chance. I'm not the kind. I'm not the kind who can do it ethically, who can live ethically. I have to live with my friends like I did. Or there's a way out in humor, in the category of humor, and that's very interesting, where he puts it, very close to the religious, so that the man who has a good sense of humor, the person who has a good sense of humor, is very likely the more religious person. The person who has no sense of humor probably hasn't discovered what real religion is, or the Christian religion. And humor, of course, the comic and the tragic are made up of the same qualities. The best illustration of that is probably the a drunken man hanging onto a pole, stroking it and fondling it and speaking endearingly to it. And you come along and see that, and your first reaction is to chuckle. There's the gap. What he pretends to be and what he is, what he ought to have been and what he is. There's the gap. And why do you chuckle? Because he is a comic figure. He's a caricature of what he ought to be. And you chuckle. Unless you come close and discover that it's your brother or your husband or your, you know, somebody like that, then you stop chuckling and you probably are moved to cry, to tears. But the gap is the source of comedy and the source of tragedy. That which you pretend to be and aren't makes you a clown, and yet makes you tragic. Now, if a little child runs along at the age of 2 or 3 and does like this, and you ask, what are you doing? And he tells you, I'm an airplane, I'm flying, and you chuckle, that's kind of nice. That's, he's pretending to be that which he isn't. But let him do that at the age of 18, and you no longer chuckle. This has become rather tragic. He's running around pretending to be an airplane at the age of 18. Now, we pretend to be what we aren't. And we're doing it all over the place. Somebody said that the greatest clown of this century was Adolf Hitler. He was the greatest caricature, and therefore the greatest clown. He was the most tragic figure, too. He pretended to be in control of forces that he was never in control of and that destroyed him. But he pretended to be that. And I remember the instance of a Greek, the writer of Greek tragedy, who said that, told about his friend standing there visiting with him, and then he invited his friend to come back tomorrow for lunch. And the friend said, yes, I'll come back, be there at 12 o'clock. And he walked a few paces, and a stone dislodged itself from up there and fell on his head, and killed him right there. And this writer of Greek tragedy said, I laughed and I laughed and I laughed. He had just said he was coming tomorrow and he's not coming tomorrow. He pretended to be in control and he wasn't. So he was a comic figure. And suddenly that stone falling on his head disclosed him as a clown. Well, this is a very intriguing thing, this ability to laugh. And is there any other creature to whom God has given that gift? And the gift of laughter, or the sense of humor, or the sense of the comic is very close to religion. I think when the pastor, old-time pastors used to do it, I rarely did it, if ever, in making the announcements, of course, we use bulletins. In making the announcements, the old pastor would say, God willing, we'll have church tomorrow or next Sunday. He was just guarding himself against being a clown. He didn't want to look funny. Because supposing he had said not, hadn't said God willing, and said we'll have church tomorrow, and suppose he broke his back or died in the meantime, everybody'd say, well, what a funny guy he was. He said he was going to have church on Sunday. And this whole business of pretending to be in control and not being in control, or pretending to be what we aren't, That's the source of humor, a good humor. And it's like you're saying, don't take yourself so seriously. And that word could very well come from the cross. That remember this gap. That's not going to kill you because I've taken care of it, which will happen in the religious stage. But you can't, you know, it's an escape. Let's come back to that after we go to the religious. The religious stage is where finally the gap is bridged or is brought together by forgiveness, by the cross. Your sins, though they be scarlet, they are as scarlet, there's a tremendous gap, are nonetheless white as snow. There's no condemnation to them that are in Christ. Though you are guilty, your guilt has been removed. And in the eyes of God, you appear as you have never sinned. There is a reconciliation. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he taken away this gap. Now, don't be paralyzed by it anymore. Don't go into panic anymore. Don't be crushed by it anymore, because it's been taken care of. So he couches the whole thing that is essential. Reconciliation of the gap is in forgiveness. What you should be, you now are. What you should do, you have in Christ, you have done. And you are released from the torment of this gap. Now you can go back. After all, it's a kind of de jure deal. The facts are still there. You do fall short. The good you would, you still don't do. The evil you would not do, that you still do. As a child of God, as a person who has, by faith through grace, has had that gap brought together. But you can stand this gap now. It can be an arena where you do battle. And granted that you're never going to bring them together, you're going to have, by God's help, you're going to have some fun dealing with a gap, because at the heart of the universe, it's been taken care of. And you can even now chuckle over the gap, because it's not just tragic. The tragic part has been largely taken care of by God at the cross. And the whole world, you can find some relief in seeing how funny it is. And yet, what a tragic thing it is. But God has been around and given you a chance now not to take yourself so seriously as before, as the gap would have driven you mad. You had to get out of that gap. When Paul said, the good I would, and who will deliver me? He had to be delivered, either back to the ascetic stage, give it up, or principally into humor. But humor isn't good enough. You can't sit and chuckle over the world's sins all the time, or over your own. There are times that you better, for your mental health, just see how funny it is. I read one of my favorite books from high school, I suppose. It was Sabatini's Scaramouche, and I picked it up a year or so ago and read it again, and I like the description. I like the character. I like the description in the first part. He was born with a gift of laughter and a sense that the world was mad. And you'd think at first that would demolish him, but he's a person of high integrity, great compassion, and wit. And this strain, the sense that the world was mad, was just a recognition with the touch of humor of a gap. And it gave him health, gave him. I think I read when former Archbishop Fisher of Canterbury, when he retired, he said, all my life through, and particularly as Archbishop, I've been able to get up each morning with the anticipation for what bad news the morning mail might bring. And he said, at the moment, I'm beginning to lose a little zest for it, and I think I ought to retire. I thought, gee, isn't that nice? Isn't that nice to see a bad world? And then to have this little escape, this sense of humor. He wasn't taking it less seriously, but he was simply recognizing that it's there. That it's there. And the Lord honors us with giving us a chance to help him deal with it. Suffer with him, if you will, or whatever. I'm very intrigued by this gift or this sense of humor, because I think we're always in danger of losing it. I think I grew up in a religious environment where it was totally lost, and therefore there wasn't much fun. It was solid stuff, and I have no reason to go back and say that I wish it had been profoundly different, but there could have been. There could have been a gift of laughter in the midst of this very serious business of living. Let me see. Okay, let's. If you've got some observations to make, some questions, I think it's a very intriguing treatment, and we're proud. I hope we are in all stages. I know we're in the aesthetic stage, because so much of our lives get to be lived. We think we choose a course, but we're really pushed into it. But that's all right. If we recognize that, and then the ethical stage. If we aren't frauds and in our pretenses, are dishonest with God, and become thorough clowns. And then that we've understood been deeply settled, let's say, by the religious state, or in the religious state, with forgiveness and the closing of the gap once and for all before God, freeing us to deal with the gap again without panic and without paralysis. Well, Kierkegaard, if you hear me, I apologize for things I have misrepresented you in, but thank you for prodding us.
The rest of them with him are all laughing.
Yeah. Now, do you remember where it comes from? You talked about in the aesthetic stage, you said that a lot of people, you talked about twice born sort of, you know, once or twice born people, because a lot of people, the only time they ever move into a sort of a second nature, sort of a new button from pure his point of view, is when they fall in love. And he was very, running battle on the position of women, which is so bad. But I don't like to discuss it too much, because I don't like to have women feel like Church for Hans to say doesn't have gospel. But he did say that the only chance of a new view of life for many people came only in the marriage relationship, mm-hmm. which was still under the aesthetic,
mm-hmm.
that it was still being just simply driven, but it did give you a relationship with somebody outside yourself, although it was an enlarged self.
Mm-hmm.
And he did say that that was the only whole way to live, that he did any of us do.
Yeah. I don't remember that specifically, but I do remember that he uses marriage as an analogy for the Christian life, where the spontaneous, the drifting, or the wanting to, gets combined with the imperative, the, you know, having to, duty.
But I remember, yeah, right, and it's that he doesn't use it in the way that, he doesn't use it the way it's used in Scripture, except in the ideal form, but he says it just and really, when you stop to think of it, it's a very true statement.
Mm-hmm.
For many people, and you think of the whole business with Mother's Day or Father's Day or what have you, and the fact that people make a great thing of the kind of deeds that are done by parents, not on an ethical basis, really, although they look ethical, but they are done because these children are an extension of me, and therefore I want to be sure that my ego and my image is being taken care of in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way he developed it. I remember once getting quite a long lecture, and I found my old notes on it.
Well, I had courage, as you know, when I was just out of the university, and I had the advantage of Swinson, and there were no Kierkegaard followers on the horizon yet. I had courage then to represent him, because nobody could be critical of me, but since that time there's been all kinds of my friends are far better Kierkegaard students than I am, so I'm a bit cautious about pretending to be his emissary.
The thing about you though, Al, is that you took him on an original basis instead of everybody that has been a Kierkegaard scholar since. Busy reading all the commentaries.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. Yeah. You know, I was going to say that, isn't it true, I don't remember whether this is brought together or not, but it just occurred to me, that that which I want to do, once I'm in touch with God, that which I ought to do, which is a kind of dour duty, gets changed by God so that it becomes what I want to do, so that my appetite, let's say, or my inclination for something happens to coincide with what God wants me to do, or what I ought to do. So that you can't say that it's just drifting. It's kind of a miraculous coming together of the spontaneous and the having to duty, I suppose, in its finest form, is also made a desire. Okay, the sun is shining and you've sat here long enough.